Welcome back to another episode of Keeping It Cool. So we've interviewed some super interesting founders on our show, but founders are only one side of the equation when it comes to entrepreneurial endeavors. We also need to consider venture capitalists and other investors. So today's podcast guest, Murad Yagmai, has experience being an entrepreneur, an operator, and an investor. He is the managing partner of Cool Climate Collective, where he brings together investors and operators to support early stage climate tech founders. He also co-founded Queros, an AI-driven platform shaping the future of work, where he led product management and partnerships. He also served as program director of Terra.do's Climate Change for VCs program, helping venture investors explore climate tech opportunities through a mix of climate science and investment theses. A serial entrepreneur, Murad previously founded Customize.co, an AR-enabled home decor startup, and grew it to a successful exit. He advised startups and SMEs on growth strategies at Power of Art, a Dubai-based venture studio. He also previously engaged public and private entities to develop programs with UAE government entities. Beyond his ventures, Murad is deeply involved in the climate ecosystem as an angel investor and podcast producer. You should check out his podcast called Climate on the Edge. He co-created Solutions the Game, a climate action card game funded on Kickstarter, and has appeared on the In Good Hands podcast. He holds a BA in political science from UC San Diego. Murad and I had a great chat about his career and some of his investments through Cool Climate Collective, so I'm super excited for y'all to listen to this podcast. Without further ado, let's get into it. Hey, Murad, welcome on the show. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And so can you tell me a little bit about your background? I know we just talked about it a little, but you started out as an entrepreneur. Can you tell me a bit about your journey and how you became where you are now?
Yeah, I'll try and keep it short, but I think it's sort of how my career started. So I actually studied international relations at UC San Diego, thinking I might get into NGO work or something more with a global lens and thinking from a systemic approach, how we can solve like big problems, or known as wicked problems in the world.
Cool.
I graduated in 2009, like kind of post-2008 financial crisis. I had spent some childhood years in Dubai, and one of my old childhood friends told me about Dubai's been growing, you should come check it out. I ended up getting a project manager at a manufacturing firm. Nothing to do with my background. It's just more, I have common sense and I can figure things out. Why don't you come in?
So you got hired in that position right out of college?
Yeah. I ended up just applying whatever I could to the space I was in. And this manufacturing firm did various work across hospitality, construction, all types of manufacturing requirements. And I just did rotations between different projects. And eventually that kind of led to me coming up with a spin-off concept for them. And it was in the e-commerce. If you're familiar with Shutterfly, you can like order goods online, custom images. So that kind of pulled me into the venture world. But again, nothing to do with climate at that time. I spent a couple of years there. And from there, after exiting that position, I got involved with local ecosystems. So as a former entrepreneur in this space, I got tapped into for incubators and accelerators to help on the programming. Initially, just do initial workshops myself. But then from there, can you develop the programs for these? Again, very industry agnostic, depending what the program objective was, health tech, fintech, small business. So developing these 10-week programs, usually 6-month to 9-month engagements on my end. Again, not climate, but I think it was just applying different skills and viewpoints to different industries.
Kind of like an accelerator program? I guess,
accelerator, incubator as well, where it's like they don't even have an idea. And like, how do you seed them with ideas and ideation forming? Yeah.
Cool. And then I guess what took you into climate seems like a pretty big shift from where you were.
Yeah. So when I moved back to California in 2020, there was this red sky fire event, like a wildfire event. And I remember when I was in San Diego, I believe it was 2007, I was evacuated for a wildfire. But the difference between what I witnessed in 2007 and what I witnessed in 2020 was like night and day difference. Like literally the sky was red. I'm like, wow, this is a big problem area. I should probably see if I can do something about this. I was always curious and interested in climate, but I said, well, I've been doing ecosystem building or with the systems kind of multi-stakeholder lens. Is there something I can do in climate? So I said, why don't I raise my hand, get involved with whatever projects I could find just to acclimate myself to the climate science, the opportunity problem statements. And then I spent the next couple of years exploring that as well. I'm happy to go into individual, but yeah, that's...
Sure. Yeah. That's super cool. So now I know that you have your own fund, Cool Climate Collective. How long have you been investing with the fund?
So yeah, Cool Climate Collective started in 2021. I was wrapping up my time at TerraDo's Climate Change for VCs program. So I was a program director there. And just to give some background, the program was designed to help investors, whether it's corporate VCs, family offices, high net worth angels, develop kind of like their climate investment thesis. We divided it 3 weeks of climate science and 3 weeks of like investment thesis development.
Got it. And so you're kind of running that program.
Yeah. And my approach to it was always, we'll always try and keep it grounded to what people already know. So if you're already a real estate investor and you do prop tech or real estate deals, what is kind of like the next step for energy efficiency or water efficiency within your own portfolio of assets? So it was always about like, how do you find the closest thing to what they're comfortable with? And then digging deeper on that. And what I started Cool Climate Collective was around, well, I have a lot of other former founders and operators in my network. And before we started the fund, we started the syndicate. So it was about syndicating investments that I was seeing through just founders approaching me and my network. And as we were due diligencing them and developing our frameworks for diligence, we started to leverage that network. So it was always about not just financial capital, but what I always say, social and intellectual capital. So if we're going to invest, we're going to see if our network can help and if any insights or our past experiences can support a lot of these more technical founders. A lot of our network were people who'd gone to market or grown and scaled companies, hired individuals. Well, those best practices are some things we've learned. Can we impart that to the founders we invest in as well?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like a lot of people don't know how much of venture capital is just networking and connecting, you know, potential founders to the right people so their businesses can scale. That's super cool. I'm curious. So you mentioned that you helped other people develop their investment theses, but what kind of companies do you invest in? Is it more based on the resources you know you have in your network, or is there like a particular theme that you try to go for within climate? And what does that look like for you?
I think it's one, what you hinted at, what's within our network. That's definitely something where we only invest if we think we can somehow in some shape leverage the other two. So beyond financial capital, the social and intellectual, if we can leverage those, then it will be a fit for us to even explore further. Because if you just want us for capital, we're not doing massive checks. There's a lot bigger funds and firms that can do that. But if you think there's more value to what we can bring, one, let's have a conversation. But part of that is also the thesis around go-to-market, and just underlying layer for me was around, if these businesses want to scale the impact they do, we can't be dependent on regulatory policies. So that means maybe even incentives like carbon credits, and which are for now voluntary. If that's the case, an election cycle happens, as we might have seen now. And so from early on, we were avoiding anything that felt dependent on some outside market mechanism and more driven by, well, what does the consumer or business want? Would they be willing to, and I don't want to put it into like green premium or discount kind of lens, because people will pay the premium as long as the value is more than just the green sustainable part.
Yeah,
so that makes sense. It's not about, it has to be a cheaper product specifically, but it just has to be superior. And a lot of the fundamental underlying is like, as long as it's not dependent on a carbon credit scheme, as long as there's an underlying business use case, could be supply chain, consumer oriented, but it's like better for you, healthier for you. And then more impact for us is also multi-solving. So it's not only CO2 equivalent, but if this displaces this one component and can create jobs and create certain things in the community, and it does have that climate layer to it, it doesn't need to be driven by this CO gigaton as many funds kind of do. Like, we don't have that mandate. And it's more about, do we think this business can scale? We always make the assumption, if we're among the few only investors in this thing, others don't see the value right now. Could, with just the funding and the network we can provide, enable it to grow to the next milestones? And if the answer is yes, we like to look at that. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're more driven by market forces and the impact that the companies can have. Can you tell me also, I'm curious, so you kept saying we, a little bit more about your team, how you got together, and how you kind of make decisions with the both of you?
Yeah. So I actually met Tristan. He came through the Climate Change for VCs program. So he was previously at 500 Startups, which is now known as 500 Global. He'd done a lot of accelerated work across the world in different countries. So he had this worldview lens that we kind of vibed on. And if you think about climate, it is a global problem. We can't just have, even if one nation decides to do it, we kind of need a buy-in on even the solutions to be scaling globally. So we connected. He had a lot more experience than me on, I would say, the venture specific side. I'd done some consulting for family offices, but I'd never fully managed my own fund. I'd never kind of even run syndicates in that way. I'd done angel investing, but I wasn't rallying people around a memo and diligence. So we teamed up. And since then, he has a full-time gig himself separately, but he engages a venture partner helping, you know, with the network side and kind of new connections. He's a really well-connected guy. And what I've been working on is like the internal processes and how do we leverage other ad hoc operators. So we have a lot of other interesting individuals in the network. Recently with Teddy, we've been working on how do we do better investor relations and grow out some of our workflows on for like a platform play. Overall, there's a lot of individuals. We run ad hoc investment committees as well. So typically what I do once we look at something we like that comes through our deal or referral, if it's a fit from the initial thesis I told you, we send out a link to our form, like a scorecard mechanism that we've developed, to typically five to six, usually three technical experts and three market industry expertise, and get their inputs. Doesn't necessarily mean we only go by that IC's decision, but those inputs inform the rest of it. We even have a few custom GPTs that we've developed, more going back to some of my past work and Foresight Futures work, where it's more just for scenario modeling of where we think things could go. If X happens, where do we think the market will be 5 years from now? But if Y happens, what do you think that market could be? So it's something I developed called the three futures test. It's really just forecasting that a lot of Foresight Futures people use, but it's now in an AI-driven form. So we started in late 21 and when GPT came out in November 22. So we've really leveraged as much of that into just how we're planning to scale and grow. And we do have a fund now as well, but we still do the SPV, the syndicates as well.
Cool. Sounds great. It sounds like you've really been able to use that to make your team a lot bigger than it actually is, which is awesome. So I thought it would be fun to talk about some of the companies that you've invested in that are particularly innovative. One that I found is called InventWood. So InventWood manufactures a product called Superwood, which empowers builders to create buildings with reduced costs and construction times because their product replaces steel and it also stores carbon in the process. So I know manufacturing is a big source of carbon emissions, particularly in the materials space. Super interesting company. Curious how you came upon them. How did you source this company?
Well, this was a kind of interesting one because I actually met the chairman during COP28 in Dubai. So I ended up being back in Dubai, especially if COP28 was happening too, in a place where I spent a decade working at. The name was like the Business and Philanthropy Forum. And we were just talking and I didn't realize who he was, Alex, at that time. We just really hit it off talking about our thesis around climate and all the different forums. We were kind of listening to the panelists talk. And then he pulled out the little sample he had. And going back to what you were saying, like, yes, construction is definitely one of the places and steel in itself, because of it's a hard to abate sector for the most part because of the way the process works and you require heat.
Yeah.
But on top of that, steel itself, there's a weight component. I think like one layer is, yes, the production side and all the carbon emissions from the production and the sourcing of the supply itself. But in itself as well, as you do construction on site, the weight of the material plays a role in, say, the time things can finish. So I think, yes, we looked at it from this can, you know, embodied carbon. It has all these layers. And previously with a family office, I'd looked at cross-laminated timber or mass timber. So that was always an interest area for me. And they kind of would modify the wood in a way where now you get kind of the benefits of CLT or mass timber, but you also get superior properties. And it's not just only from can we match steel strength or even be better than steel strength, but potentially be lighter. And that for me was like the real unlock when we were looking and discussing this further. It's like, well, now you're telling me the shipping of those goods or on site when they're actually starting to utilize these goods, it can be like the Superwood is the kind of like the brand they have. It's really, that's where the differential is. I think there are some construction or builders that might care about climate and sustainable, but going back to our thesis, like, why would they fundamentally care? And also, even if it's stronger than steel, do they need it to be stronger than steel? Like, for the most part, many people just think of what's the regulations. As long as we hit that, it's good enough.
Yeah.
So the real unlock for me was thinking, just extrapolating, well, if we can deliver the same properties, even if we don't talk about superior, but it's lighter, that's where it starts to get really interesting. Because now you can actually think about, wait, how does it affect our labor on site? How does that affect our shipping or moving with trucks loads of this material? That's where, you know, as you extrapolate, where could this go? that's where we start to think, well, maybe this does have a chance of penetrating the steel industry, at least to, you know, within the confines of the type of product they release. It obviously won't replace 100% of steel, even with full, you know, mass market adoption. But it was more about, it's an opening, and that we like to take those bets.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, mass timber is super interesting, and it's cool that you have this product on top of that. I've definitely heard that because it is lighter and more simple, you can have a lot fewer people on site when you make a project with some of these different resources. I know you're curious about the market factors and how the product is going to be adopted in the market. So I'm curious from a cost perspective, how it compares that, you know, sometimes when it comes to lending, people put premiums on products like mass timber because they're not sure how it's actually going to perform or what the insurance might be. So I'm just curious from you're interested in market forces. So how does that kind of play out?
Yeah, I mean, definitely what you said, you think of the labor costs on site, right? Do you need more labor, or with the same amount of labor, could you get more done? And that reduces your project scope and timelines. Definitely. I think even the financing side, obviously when things are new and as their plants, the lines of their plant are coming online, we should see that economies of scale that we always hope to see with these type of technologies. But I think it was more that it does show a pathway to it without requiring more sudden breakthroughs. It's more orders, and it becomes a market kind of play, right? And who do they sell to, you know, developers, builders, and the types of individuals they're already discussing with is what further showed like bullishness on our side. And sorry, I don't know if they revealed who their other investors are, but when they eventually do, it also speaks to the quality of the individuals engaging. And you hinted at something where some other investors with us have actually decided to finance with like a debt to equity play. So they actually see the value of like, hey, this will pay off. And we actually, rather than collect more interest in the debt form, we think longer term in equity. So the design and the structure of how they're looking at it, they clearly have longer term, and that these are a lot bigger pockets than us. So that in itself speaks to, well, if they see a financial product here, and that for me is always something that when we look at companies, do we see a pathway for, forget climate investors, let's put climate investors aside. Can you co-opt the broader financial industry? And can there be interesting financial instruments or products created out of this solution or technology? If the answer hints at yes, that's where, from two perspectives, obviously, yeah, venture, you'll probably do good because this has mass adoption and can scale. But from the other side, impact, right? Like, that's where now, if a lot more finance flows into this space and it really unlocks, well, now it's also going to be really impactful. So I think that is something we do consider. We might not say we have to think that this has to hit a gigaton. Like I said, like that's not one of the requirements, but we definitely do look at it when we do that forecasting and thinking through the scenarios in the future. Well, what's required? What's the bottleneck? Well, great. Even if you have this technology and it works, can they even scale out to multiple plants in different regions across the United States? Because right now, in Maryland, but like, where could the other locations be? Could they be co-located close to some of those timber sources or wood-based sources required for the technology? And if the answer is yes, well, does this maybe potentially play into another co-benefit is wildfire management, like land, forest debris, all that kind of plays a role in another problem on the build side, or it's like the destruction. And well, if it also happens to be a superior material that maybe gives you more resistance against those types of threats, even better. I don't know if you've seen pictures from the LA wildfires, like a few homes that survived were actually the ones that maybe had steel or had some other kind of like passive designs within them. Well, CLT in general, but also InventWood's technology, it kind of has these superior attributes that in those bad scenarios, and that hints to what you said, insurance, right? If it starts to prove itself and it unlocks something, now on the other flip side, it's like, well, maybe down the line, we're going to see insurance products or insurers demanding certain types of regulatory if they want to underwrite something, or it just becomes a superior thing where it's just cheaper. Like, oh, the premiums on this home because of the materials. Again, that's, we haven't seen that yet, but that's a future we potentially envisioned.
Yeah.
So there's a few factors from the financial instruments that we're looking at when we look at these things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like I was surprised to learn about mass timber that is actually very fireproof in a way that you would not expect because it's wood.
Yes.
Just curious from, a business perspective. I know you kind of touched on this a little, but just in terms of the business model of the company, is InventWood mainly selling to distributors, builders, a mix of both? How are they approaching their go-to-market strategy with the new product?
Right now, it's mostly builders. Like, you just want to get onto project sites.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, like, you definitely want distribution. I think at this moment, again, you only have certain resources and how many markets you can kind of tackle. So even like the first few products are not directly now that steel beam kind of play, the I-beam that's known in steel, but something that's more approachable, something that will allow them to get to market quicker. But that is the objective is, yes, you want to hit everything. Distribution is obviously one of the things you once you crack it. And I think the reason you don't jump into distribution kind of play is the scale. Right? Or can you even crank out what a distribution partner would, if they're able to kind of get into all their projects, would it make sense? So, but whereas right now with direct builders or property developers, you can engage on a project basis and also collect that data. I think we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Data matters, especially one from regulatory, everything else in from the insurance, all those layers. We need more data beyond just what's being done in the lab and a few kind of like sites. It's like we need more deployments. So yes, I think go to market for now is project developers, builders, distributors is definitely on the roadmap. And it comes down to how fast can we scale and get the additional lines at the plant live.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I know you touched on this in a lot of your answers already, but I just want to kind of bring it back to this product specifically. What was really the thing that pushed you over the edge to make the investment in InventWood? Like, what was the key takeaway? I know there were a lot of benefits that you mentioned, how it aligned with your investment thesis, but was there anything in particular where you were like, yes, this is a great investment, I want to support this company?
I think everything I talked about was really the technology and where we see financial play. But I think one of the main things that really pushed it up over the edge was the team, the founding inventor, the technology, and like the potential future use cases of this core technology into other types of interesting wood technology. I think just even going back to the chairman, Alex, a driven individual and well-connected individual. I think that's something where like you look at a founder, it's like, well, that's a definite bonus. Like I don't want to say like it's something you said, but like venture for a lot of times is who you know. And in this case, someone who is former founder, being with other interesting companies, has had a lot of success in the past. That definitely helps, like an experienced individual who understands the market specifically. Don't discount that part at all. Like I definitely the technology, the potential of what the technology will unlock from financial instruments and you know, the materials itself. But it all began with an initial relationship, meeting the individual, meeting Alex, having a few conversations. He came to one of the dinners we hosted at COP28. And just through that relationship, and it did take a couple months of like building the trust. Obviously, while we do due diligence, is also getting to know the individual. So yes, the individuals are a big part of most investments we make as well. It's not just, I should caveat, I don't think we share, but we focus on the pre-seed to A range. And those are where the individual people right now at the company, where, you know, maybe you're Series B, C, you can afford to hire out a lot more experienced individuals or hire a consultant to solve for some of the tactical problems. But in those early stages, it's whoever's on the company, whoever's on board that really matter. And then can they also leverage us? It goes back to what our own thesis, where he saw value in what we could do and our network as well. And if we have that mutual alignment of, and we can help one another out and we align to your vision, and this is how we think we could help your vision execute on that vision. Yeah, that definitely plays a role.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Networking and especially the team at those early stages, just like you mentioned, it's kind of like the only thing that's going to be consistent about those companies is the team, right? If they do a pivot or if, you know, everything changes, you're still going to have the same team members. So that trust seems super important. Cool. So thank you for sharing all of that. I was also interested in one of your other investments, Electric Fish. So Electric Fish is enabling microgrid solutions to quickly enable fast EV charging and backup energy resources at grid-constrained sites. So basically, they're developing microgrids in places where it might be challenging to put said microgrids and EV chargers. Kind of talking about the relationship aspect, you mentioned that you met the other founders at COP28. How did you meet the founders of Electric Fish and how did you find this company?
This is more typical of our deal flow. It's a Cool Climate Collective member introduced me to Vince, one of the co-founders of Electric Fish. I got to meet him, Anurag, and even go visit them in San Carlos. So it was referral. So it is like who you know. And it just happened to be one of our Cool Climate Collective members who already talked to them. A lot of, and that's, I would say, maybe 60-70% of our deal flow is like that, where it's just as our network grows. And I think just to add to what you previously asked was, yes, what does inform some of our types of companies we'll look at is what domain expertise we have within our network. But our network is also continuously growing. I think like if you say what we looked at when we started in late 21 to what we look at now, we look at a lot more things because we have a lot more diverse views and experiences. And that also informs the deal flow we get. It's like, oh, we're getting some very niche coming out of lab technologies that are really fringe. And that because that not only from our own network of investors and operators, but also our founders. So our founders also occasionally meet people deep within domains and they're like, you know what? You should talk to our investor, especially he was one of our first investors. He'll probably enjoy just getting on a call. And what I was trying to say is if we start to go through a diligence process, I hope at least, even if we don't come to, we think we're going to invest, hopefully one, as part of our diligence process, you will get a few insights about your own company because we go into various layers. We do
super cool.
An IP review. The Climate Patent Collective is something we help spin up to help not only our portfolio companies, but now helps companies at other larger, like lower carbon third derivative, whether it's on workshop or IP work. But for us, it's part of our due diligence process. So we'll do that IP review and provide that feedback to the founders as well. So it doesn't matter if they already have IP counsel or anything. It's more like, here's a third party reviewing it. Here's the thoughts, right? And then that comes as part of our due diligence process. So, but that's one small layer of it.
Cool. Amazing. So curious about how the chargers that Electric Fish is developing compare to existing chargers and how the technology supports local grid resilience. Can you just talk a little bit more about those pieces of the company?
Yeah, I'm going to try and keep it as simple as possible. Pretty much when you want to do fast charging, faster than like a regular plug, you need to do some level of upgrade to the grid typically if it doesn't have something and it requires trenching. So if you're going to have to do all that work, all of a sudden the cost of setting up these fast charging locations starts to jump up. What they've been able to do is by coupling it with a battery as well as their core technology within the device, they can work with whatever already exists on site and deliver kind of that fast charging experience. For simplistic sake, it's imagine you charge the battery really slow, but the battery can discharge at those super fast charge rates. So, and now depending on your grid resilience requirement, if this is coupled with, and typically in the past, like think on a government level, you know, if this is a government site or a fleet of vehicles, like these are the types of clientele that they've had, you might require the battery backup for the actual infrastructure. So you can choose whether it's like, well, do we need to give fast charging right now? We can just do slow charge, like just go through the system and kind of like play with it and just maintain the level of backup potential. And when you don't need it, you can discharge it at the fast charge rate. So in the fleet cases, which is one of their clientele, you know, you have a bunch of EVs you're trying to sell and prove, and you're doing test drives and all those components, whether you're rental or you're an actual company that sells EVs, you have a lot of EVs on site. Typically, you either aren't doing fast charging or you're limited by the speed and rate. And that doesn't really work out if you're either trying to rent them out. And it's like, oh, wait, we can't really give out a car that doesn't have
it's dead.
More than 30% charge. So we need to, in the next 30 minutes, get it up to 80, 100%. That's where the fast charge really makes a difference at specific times. But at the same time, you know, there's a layer to that. As soon as you bring in batteries, and this is just broader Electric Fish, but even just other companies, as soon as you bring batteries, there's always energy arbitrage. Like the fact that most utilities have peak, off-peak rates, if you're able to charge your battery at off-peak rates and then reduce your dependence on peak rates, there's already an ROI on that alone. And then everything else I said was like, well, the ROI comes from, well, if this is a critical facility and if battery or power goes out and you need the power, let's say refrigeration or something, if that goes out, the loss of those goods is a lot worse than anything else. So you require some level of a microgrid or battery backup. So, well, what if you also are using, so just go through this statement, it's like, well, what if you're also using electric trucks, right? Like say in this dual scenario, it's like, well, charging those trucks, you definitely need fast charging or else you're going to spend like days just only to charge one truck. But at the same time, when you require it, well, that same refrigeration for the warehouse or the facility, it's critical. Like you just can't risk not having power when you need power for some of these places. And obviously certain markets need it more because of brownout, blackout requirements, but some are just critical infrastructure. And I think that's where if you can lower the cost enough for someone to do this, and you're not only doing all that trenching like just for an EV, but you're doing it in this dual microgrid capacity, the value now starts to shine in multiple ways. Obviously for different clientele. They have a different use case, but there's a few different things you could do when you have the ability to choose when to charge, when to discharge, and how fast to discharge. That's where it gets interesting.
Yeah, cool. Sounds like they're operating in the realm of demand response also, which is super interesting and I'm sure is going to become more and more prevalent in our lives. You mentioned that some of their customers operate full fleets of vehicles. They can be, you know, public, private, government. Maybe you can't go into this as much, but I'm just curious who the main customers are for Electric Fish. Are there certain groups that they're targeting? People, yeah, that have, it sounds like they can service a variety of needs. So I'm just curious also about, you know, what their customers are.
Yeah, I think I just put, like, give you the persona then. It's like, well, if they either have an EV fleet, whatever purpose they're using the EV fleet for, and if they happen to potentially have a critical infrastructure building. And the point of the EV fleet side is more from a, well, ROI on these fleets is utilization. And utilization means how much of the battery or how much of it can be filled and the car can go out as fast as possible. That's like one layer to it. I mean, just I'll give a hypothetical example. I think the Waymos and these, not specifically autonomous, but like in general, anyone doing those type of fleet, thinking taxi service or even rental cars, the more you get the vehicles out there and you're arbitraging the difference between gas prices and, you know, electricity yeah, charges. That's one. And then on top of that, the sub layer of the peak to off peak, if you're able to charge at that cheaper rate and also at the right time to discharge a lot more power at once, it starts to get very attractive. Again, there's layers to the economics here, but it is really just an economics play. And then there are certain cases, they've done a few deployments in kind of like national park, kind of regional park type of plays where it's like, well, you know, it's semi-remote. They don't have, or it's not even easy to upgrade the grid over there, but one maybe from EV as well, but even just visitors, right? If they require something. And it just happens to also be a backup for some of that critical infrastructure in these very remote places. So again, that might be a smaller market or niche, but it's just the technology can serve multiple purposes. And a lot of times from our thesis side, we like the idea of multi-solving, right? I did talk about like the co-benefits of like impact can look like multiple things. But I even think sometimes technology solutions can multi-solve where it's not only for the electric trucks. It's also for, like you said, public, private institutions with infrastructure could utilize their technology as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm just curious. So the chargers that they're building, they are compatible with a lot of the cars already on the market. Is there any like transition that these fleet operators have to do to be able to use these chargers, or they're just kind of like ready to go?
No. They just utilize the standard. It's escaping me right now, but the standard charger that everyone has agreed to, it's an acronym. It's not coming to me right now.
I don't know. Okay. And there's a lot of EV charging companies out there. Curious what motivated you to make the investment in Electric Fish?
I think, again, came back to the team's resilience. So in this case, it's actually, it doesn't fit the full typical venture persona where like I just want fast growth and what's my markup on the next investment. It was more, well, they've been resilient enough to be around for a while, really perfecting their tech, doing deployments. Like, so it's not like it was a technology readiness level that it actually exists. It's being deployed. And it was more like, is the market starting to be ready for it? I think that's where for us was Tesla aside, we just saw a lot more EV vehicles coming to market. And then on top of that, that microgrid resilience play, what you said, demand response, it might not be there yet, but I think a lot more cities, local communities are looking kind of what can we do in such situations. So I think it's a where we see the maturity is getting there. And it's like, well, okay, now's the right time. And the team's been scrappy enough to operate where it's like, they started years ago and they were really perfecting their tech, and they had a few other competitors that were in the market and they kind of fizzled. They just went the full, let's just grow fast. Let's just do focus on EV chargers and without like that multi-solving or additional kind of co-benefits play. So yeah, it was a mix of the team and their resilience as an individual, but even their technology's resilience of like, I think there's a few markets here and we're going to figure it out. And we're going to figure out where it can really penetrate.
Yeah, it's cool that they have both the mitigation piece through, you know, the electric vehicles and also the adaptation with the grid resilience. It's kind of a nice comprehensive company. That's awesome. Okay, well, I appreciate you talking about those investments. Super interesting to hear kind of your rationale behind what you're investing in and what these teams are working on, which is awesome. I'm curious, what is next for Cool Climate Collective and what is next for you? I know you've had, you know, some other ventures in the climate space too. So just curious how those things are going to continue to grow.
Yeah, I think what we've started to realize now with Cool Climate Collective is we have many operators and former founders really thinking, what can I do in climate? It doesn't matter what their background was before in terms of they weren't in climate. I think we can, just through discussions and pulling them into the initial kind of like due diligence process, we start to uncover where they might be a fit. There might be in a portfolio company, but what we've lately been looking at is like, could we spin out more projects or initiatives? And there's a few we're in the works with, but like I had to, the Climate Patent Collective was Alex, brilliant patent agent that wanted to do something climate, and we just figured out a way where how can we align it to our portfolio, your business model, and that exists as a small business. I don't have a stake in that. I'm just an advisor to it. But the whole idea was like, could we will this into existence? And that kind of worked out. And we're thinking, well, what are the other things that we think are problem areas? One is around storytelling and narrative, and which I'm a producer of Climate on the Edge, where we talk about frontier to climate technologies. Susan Hsu is the host, and I used to work with her on the Climate Change for VCs program, but we both came to this realization, we need to start talking about these really frontier technologies, not in a only venture investing perspective, even though we're both venture investors, is more, we need to have these discussions from R&D and have the experts even discussing with one another, because we're probably going to need these technologies in the coming decade. And we need policymakers, experts really discussing, how do we go about this? And maybe it's something for philanthropists to take up for now as an R&D kind of initiative. But we just wanted the conversation out there. But that's a flavor of what I mean by we're looking at a few other storytelling narrative plays. Like, how do we, one, help portfolio companies, right? That's one layer. But then the next layer is, well, for the ecosystem, for what else needs to be done, not only from a climate ecosystem, but the broader markets need to understand certain things. And we're looking at what do these look like, whether it's its own initiative or if it's a like a small business that supports some of these companies. And we've been also exploring something with a smaller mastermind group within the group. And hopefully by sometime mid this year, we'll launch it, but something in the private equity space. So we've been looking at something, how do we support small businesses that we, the thesis I came up with is around the climate front lines. The small businesses are the trust factor of our communities and our local businesses, but we're not leveraging them for climate, even though the technologies are actually adoptable by homeowners and renters, landlords. What are those solutions? From the venture side, we might be backing some of those technologies, but the broader side is we need distribution. We need to solve for distribution. These are the two narratives, is distribution of story, but distribution of technology. These are the 2025 goals for Cool Climate Collective.
Amazing. No, that sounds great. I think there's a lot of potential with small businesses and then also a lot of risk too. So I think there's a lot that you can deploy on both sides there. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks so much for answering all my questions. If people want to reach out to you, what would be a good way to get in touch? I can also leave something in the description of this podcast too.
Yeah. I mean, you can find me on LinkedIn, reach out cool. to me, maybe mention the podcast. So at least I know someone heard something or learned about me through that channel. But yeah, I mean, even our website, check out our website. If there's things, initiatives, like we've been doing, one of the things I didn't mention, we started to do more research, kind of like our request for X. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a startup, but it's like a solution area that we think someone should explore. We're happy to look at it as investment, co-incubation. Like I said, we have former founders willing to even jump in occasionally to the right thing if we can help something in that space, especially when we do these requests for X. It is a convening of the experts and people in our network, and we're just putting out high-level thoughts, sometimes a bit deeper as well. We like have a little white paper sessions. We're trying to figure out to publish some of these write-ups, but the bigger thing is there's a lot of things to do in climate. It's a systems problem. We're going to need a systems approach to solving for it. And, you know, you might be tackling one small thing, but there's four other things around that, and we're going to have to work together. So that's the whole ethos of the collective element of Cool Climate Collective.
Amazing. Great. Well, I will leave all those resources down below, your website, your podcast. But anyway, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.